Okay, so let's get going. We have a guest speaker here today that's going to talk to you for a little bit, and some of his content's very relevant to what we're covering, or we just covered on Thursday. And then we're going to go over the GI, finish up the GI, and maybe a little bit on the wrap-up PowerPoint. I've uploaded the new PowerPoints this weekend, so if you downloaded it on Friday, those are two new ones. And then we take a quiz, wonderful quiz, and then we'll talk about other things. So this is Sarah Martha, soon to be Dr. Sarah Martha.
Dr. Nurse.
Dr. Nurse. And she's going to tell you about some really cool research that she's doing in the College of Nursing, which relates to what we've covered in here. And I will let her take it away. She took that wonderful course that I teach, you know, that neurophysiology lab course.
Horrible.
She survived it.
I'm sure this class is horrible.
Oh, yes, it is. She always gives me a hard time. So take it away, Sarah.
So, all right, as Robin said, my name is Sarah. I'm a PhD candidate in the College of Nursing, also the Department of Neurology. He brings me in to kind of, right, tell you about other things going on campus, right? I know a lot of you guys are pre-med. Some of you may need a plan B. That's why I'm here, to be like, why don't you come to nursing, right? We're kind of like doctors, or we could become a doctor. So I'm just going to share with you a case scenario and kind of like my track of research throughout, like, because I also have a BS in biology. So throughout my BS in biology and then currently what I do now. So I started out where I got my BS in biology from Portland State, and then I came to UK for my Bachelor's of Science of Nursing, and then I entered the PhD program in 2015. So this is my third year. So my previous research experience, and, you know, I'm talking to you guys, I know some of you have to do like a lab component. I don't know really if you're all seniors or juniors, but you really should be getting into lab, especially if you are pre-med, right? You need to be getting papers, you need to be doing all these kind of things that set you apart, because as you guys know that are applying for med school, papers really set you apart, and also opportunities and networking with different kinds of people. So I first started out doing arachnid mitochondrial genomics. This was awesome in Oregon. We would do a lot of field trips on the weekend. We would go to the Cascade Mountains, Mount Hood, and we'd be searching for all sorts of arachnids, so mites, ticks, scorpions, spiders. I'd take them back to lab, I'd smash them up, and I would analyze their DNA and their genomics. And then from there, I went and I was looking at C. elegans. I did a lot of sexual reproduction, outcrossing, and a lot of like history assays. And from that experience, I got my first paper as an undergrad. I was a co-author. And I'll say that this paper, I mean, even to this day, nursing loves this, right? And again, if you're applying to med school, really kind of seek out these opportunities. Dr. Cooper is fantastic with students. All of his students, I shouldn't tell you guys, no. But they all get papers, and this is really gets you into med school. So when I came to nursing school, right, I wasn't super satisfied with just doing biology in labs. I wanted to work with people. So I went to nursing school, and when I came here, because of my experience, I wanted to continue with research. So I went to the genetics faculty member, who's Gia Mudd, and this was my first time that I actually was part of a multidisciplinary team. And so we worked with Jeff Ebersole over in dentistry, and, you know, with research and money and grants, it's really about multidisciplinary work, right? Nurses are working with doctors, but we're working with basic scientists. We're trying to learn, right, like what's going on, you know, physiologically, you can't do whatever you want to humans, as we know. And so we have to go, like, to Robin and in basic science labs and see what's going on in different model organisms that, you know, that are preserved in humans. So, like, C. elegans or crayfish, or rats or rodent models. And so for this particular work, I was delivering cardiovascular interventions. We would go to rural Kentucky, so Whitesburg, Pike County, and, right, these people are obese, and we would be giving interventions, and along the way, we would collect different biospecimens. So this was their saliva, their blood, and I would take it back to Jeff's lab, and I would analyze this for cardiovascular biomarkers. So finally, I got to graduate, right? Thank God you guys are all going to get there. But I will say something about the nursing program here. So, because I want to recruit you, right? because we need smart people that have, you know, a lot of biology experience. And so we have a summer internship program, and it's called SNAP. And SNAP, basically, if you get an interview, you're really going to get this program, or you're going to get into the internship. And it's for the whole summer. And you're paid like a nurse, and you are basically the nurse. The only thing you can't do by yourself is deliver meds, right? You have a preceptor there to help you along the way, right, give narcotics and things. But you are the nurse. And so if you get into this internship where you develop rapport in these units, they're going to want to hire you. And so the thing about UK is that we love our nurses, right? We love people that come through our program. And so that's who we hire first. So people from Louisville and Cincinnati, we don't hire them. We hire us first. And if you get in the SNAP program, then you have first dibs on the jobs. So, and coming from the ICU, which I'm a neurosurgery ICU nurse, everybody wants to be in the ICU. If you want to be a NICU nurse, right, people love babies and vaginas. those jobs are really, really hard to get when you graduate. And so, again, this program, if you get it, then you have first dibs, and that's insane. No one that I know of other programs don't have that kind of opportunity and experience. So go UK nursing. So I started off as a neurosurgery ICU nurse. Right, my patient populations, these are ischemic strokes, these are hemorrhagic strokes, we have transient ischemic attacks, right, all the different kinds of strokes, TBIs, traumatic brain injuries, right, so if you have a drug deal gone bad and somebody beats you in the head with a lead pipe, I had that patient, you end up in my unit. Or if there's gunfire exchange and you get a gunshot wound in the head, you end up in my unit. Suicide's gone wrong, end up in my unit. So these are the patients, right, that I take care of and that you get really good with. So I was at UK for about a year and a half, and then I went to DC, which is a great city, and I worked at Georgetown University. And at this time, right, I really wanted to get back into research. I love research, right? I've been doing it like you guys since biology degree. And I wasn't really seeing any opportunities in Georgetown. But I was kind of thinking of going back to school, either in D.C. or coming back here or wherever, just looking into programs. And I was also trying to think of what I could study, right? And so I was looking, because as a nurse and as a pre-med, physician, right, you're going to be inspired. And you're going to be inspired by your patients or your patients' families. And you guys will be doing research probably later because you're not just going to have a bachelor's in science. You're going to get master's. You're going to get a PhD. Even if you're a physician, there's the MD to PhD, MD-PhD programs. So I was thinking of, why do my stroke patients, if it's the same gender, the same sex, right, if they have the stroke on the same side, why is their recovery different? And so I was just trying to think of ways I'm looking up things, right? I'm like Robin, where we're just constantly reading, like, what's going on? And then I had this particular patient. And I don't know if you guys have read Brain on Fire or if you've seen the movie. This is a fantastic quick read. I recommend you guys reading this over the summer. And so there's only about 600 cases identified of autoimmune encephalitis, or as we call it in the hospital, anti-NMDA. And really what's going on, just the quick thing about this, is that you have a lot of these NMDA receptors in the brain. And what happens is that your body has this autoimmune attack on itself, right? So your brain is attacking itself. So as you guys can imagine, what you would have symptom-wise is you would have all these neuropsych symptoms, right? And so I always like to think of 16-year-old boys. So you're hypersexual. You are jumping off cliffs. You're crazy, right? But you're also not being able to walk. Your cognition's a little different. You just seem off. And so I'll get to this slide. So really it's this whole limbic area, right? Limbic, again, frontal thinkers is how I like to think about it. But your symptoms are agitation, mood lability, speech dysfunction, hallucinations, paranoia, hypersexual, seizures, and then you have all these movement disorders where, like, people move around like worms, it's the chorea, they have facial issues, like, constantly moving, and then strong rigidity, so you can't even, like, bend an elbow. So, again, this stuff is, like, this case is really, or this, I'm sorry, this disease is really, really rare. And I had a patient, her name was Diana. Usually these, about 600 cases, are usually females, 25 years old, so you guys are approaching that age, right? don't be scared. And so she cleared out all of her bank accounts. She bought two cars. She was throwing fits. She was on the ground crying. She just went completely berserk. And her husband at the time, I should say that she was an accountant, and so was her husband. And her husband at the time didn't know what to do with her, right? She's having all these issues. And so what did he do, like most of these cases? He took her to a psych ward. What's a psych ward going to do? They are going to give you Haldol. They're going to give you Ativan. They're going to give you sedatives, right, Seroquel, to, like, calm down these symptoms. And one thing, right, the brain does, which is, right, as we all know, it does a lot of things, but it also controls your breathing. So the thing that happens is that she was in the unit, and I think Susanna had a very similar story. But Susanna didn't actually go on the ventilator. Usually if these patients go on the ventilator because they can't breathe, they die. Diana stopped breathing, right? So she was sent to my ICU in Georgetown. And so we put her on the ventilator. And so, again, this stuff is really, really rare. And so I had neurologists from all over the country, right, NIH, CDC, California, everywhere, because nobody's ever seen her. Nobody's ever seen this kind of case. And so they were coming because they've read about it in textbooks, but they never actually saw her. And so they were studying her, and it was just super interesting. Again, I didn't think she would live. She coded three times in that first week. She bit through her ventilation tube, right? She's so strong. She was 40 kgs, which is 80 pounds, right? Like half my body size, basically. And I saw her break both of the bed rails. She had these movements. She busted out all the bottom teeth she had because she would grind her teeth. Are you pre-med? I saw you. Right? This kind of patient, but a lot of patients have these kind of injuries and symptoms, especially neuro patients. But she bit her tongue in half, right? It didn't matter what she put in her mouth, she was biting through it. She, again, had all these movements that I swear she levitated off the bed. And I don't know if you guys can see this, but she really reminded me of Linda Blair from The Exorcist. Like, she was like, and I describe her too as like a little Houdini. So we have, like, cloth restraints in the hospital, which you guys, if you're a tech or something, you may know about these. But you also have psych restraints. And psych restraints are heavy duty. They are black. They are thick Velcro. She would somehow escape out of them, and she would fall on the floor. I have no idea how. She would pull out every tube she had and every IV she had, right? So she was on pressors to regulate her heart rate, her blood pressure. And she was pulling out everything. She was always looking like this, right? She'd pull out her fecal tube. There was poop everywhere. There's vomit everywhere. You're like, how is she going to survive, right? She's not following commands. She has this death look in her eyes, right? There's no one home. And as a nurse and as a upcoming, you know, physician, you guys are going to be taught, always talk to your patients, right? That's what we always say. It doesn't matter if you think they're conscious or unconscious. You need to talk to your patients. So I just talked to her, and I should say, too, I had her 20 times in 2 months, which is a lot of times. You get really burnt out as a nurse and as a doctor, too. But it's a lot of contact with her, cleaning her up and making sure that she survives that day and that shift. She was in the unit for about 3 months. I'll say, 2 months into it, I noticed that there was a different look in her eye where I could see that somebody was kind of home, right? There, as a nurse, you get really good with assessments. And I just started talking to her more and more and more, right? And there was this point where, you know, she was restrained, of course, because she's crazy and, you know. I was just like, she didn't follow commands, and when she would talk, it would usually be in tongues, so you can't understand her. And it was scary. But I saw that the light was home one day, and I was like, Diana, let's get to the side of the bed. Let's sit up. And I saw she was trying to, like, move her feet right to the side of the bed. And I was like, holy crap. She's actually listening. She's following commands. This is nuts. So I undo these restraints, right? And we move her, like, or I move her kind of to the side of the bed, and she's moving on her own. And she sat up for the first time in, like, 2 months. And I was like, Diana, we're going to stand up. Let's stand up. Didn't think she could. Totally stood up. And I'm just like, you know, in disbelief, I can't even believe this right now. And there was a window in her room, probably from here to the stand. And I was like, we're going to walk. You know, let me put my arm under your arm. We're going to walk for the first time to the window. And we walked to the window. And I just started bawling, right? Because I put so much time and energy, and I didn't think she would recover. I just thought she was going to die. And so, of course, I'm crying, and I reach out to, like, you know, I start screaming, basically, to all my nurses on the floor, like, I can't believe this. I'm calling the doctors, the residents, everybody to come look at her, because we all thought she was basically dead. And she was, yeah, it was just wasn't a good thing. And so from there, she started to recover. And she, I'll tell you that, you know, from there, she went to rehab, and then she went back to her job. She doesn't remember anything, which is probably a good thing, because who would want to remember looking like that? But, yeah, she totally recovered. And so this was really my inspiration, right? I knew I couldn't study Diana. I'd have to go somewhere specific, like, you know, CDC or somewhere, or NIH. But I saw things like this in my own stroke patients. And in the hospital, we love to say, right, if you take your medication and you go to PTOT and you do these certain things, you eat better, you're going to, right, you're going to have this great linear recovery and things are going to be awesome. And that's really not the reality of things, right? You take one step forward, you take 20 steps back, you take 2 steps to the side, you have one good day where you feel great, and then you have 5 days where you feel like crap and you can't get out of bed, and people beat you up for it. So this is really, you know, how recovery should be talked about, and you guys should remember this when you're physicians. Because the first thing somebody's going to ask you if you're a neurosurgeon or something, right? They're going to say, you know, when are they going to recover? And you have to come up with a good answer. And there is no answer, right? And that's what we face on a day-to-day basis, is trying to explain that to patients and their families, especially ones from Eastern Kentucky and those rural populations. It's very, very difficult. So just to give you a little bit of background, when I came back to school, I did get together with my attending neurosurgeon, who's Dr. Frazier. If you guys work in the ED or techs, you probably know Justin Frazier. He's on my committee. And so for ischemic strokes, there are about 87% of strokes that are ischemic. 800,000 people a year suffer a stroke. It's the leading cause of adult disability, right? If you have a stroke, you're not going to go back to that job you once had, especially if it's construction. And it's such high cost. It's $35 billion in direct and indirect cost. And so really what we're talking about, right, ischemic just means, right, you have a lack of oxygen, and that's because you have a clot or a thrombus that's blocking one of your main arteries. So it's either your middle cerebral artery or your intracranial arteries. And so there's two treatments. We have TPA, which is a clot-busting drug, but then we also have mechanical thrombectomy. And so if you're within those time windows, right, for TPA, it's 4.5 hours to get treatment. We can give this in EMS, right, on the way to a level one trauma hospital like UK, which is why you guys should come to UK. Because if you go to a smaller hospital, you're not going to have that experience of seeing the worst of the worst, right, like Diana's and then worse. And you need that experience because people are going to want to hire you later. But mechanical thrombectomy we can do within now 12 to 20 hours, which is pretty awesome if it's in a large vessel like your MCA. And so really, I'll just go to this right now, I'm sorry. And so the primary injury is the infarct core, right? It's where that clot is. And so that area in red is dying and it's dead. And then the area around it in the blue and the green, that's your penumbra, and that's the area we want to rescue. And so that's why we give you treatments like TPA and mechanical thrombectomy. And the secondary injuries are really the killers, and this is what I'm looking at in my dissertation, and I'll get to that in a little bit. But certain things are going on, right? You have ion pump failures, you have increase in some of your electrolytes, you have apoptosis, right, all sorts of things, and I'll get into that. So this leads to my dissertation, and I'm exploring translational approaches to ischemic pathology and large vessel occlusion stroke, molecular responses from stroke patients to improve stroke outcomes. And I'm looking specifically at acid-base balance and electrolyte concentrations, and I know you guys recently went over some of that. And neuroinflammatory molecules that transpire in stroke in both humans, but also in rodents. And so my aim one and my aim two are very similar. And really what's going on is I want to look at these blood gases in relation to the infarct volume and or edema and mortality in either young rats, but we also work with aged rats because we want our rat models to really mimic what we see in the hospital, right? A lot of research that are done in young mice, and they're done only in like males, and that's really not what you're seeing in the hospital, right? You're seeing females, you're seeing males, you're seeing all sorts of ages, and so that's why we're addressing that in a specific aim too. So this is just showing you the model that we use in lab. This is the middle cerebral artery occlusion. Again, this is kind of what you would see in the hospital for patients with large vessel occlusion stroke. And so really, we just feed a filament up through the MCA, and we leave it. And so that would be our permanent model. But we can also remove that filament, and that is our transient model. And so the other diagram is just showing you the filament and as it goes in, and we do an incision in the neck to get it to the MCA. So the permanent model, we can think of it like if an ischemic stroke patient lives with their clot, it's the stroke in natural history. And most patients do live with their clots. They can't get to the hospital in enough time. They live in eastern Kentucky. They don't have a car, right? They don't have the helicopter to come in and take them to us. And so, again, that's if we leave the filament in the animal. And then the transient model is if a patient were to receive TPA or thrombectomy. So this is if you get a treatment and you have reperfusion. And so when we strip the animals, we take their venous blood gases before and after the stroke. And this is right, just like in the hospital when people go into surgery, we look at your vital signs. We are monitoring you throughout. And so this is a way to monitor the animal in surgery to make sure that they're hemodynamically stable. And so for the permanent model, we induce them, we take their blood gas, we stroke them, and then about 7 minutes later, we take another blood gas. And then for the transient, it's about the same, but because we leave the filament in for an hour, we take the blood gas 7 minutes after that. So it's about an hour and 7 minutes. So this leads to my specific aim three. I know it's busy, but basically what I want to do is I want to look at acid-base and electrolyte concentrations in humans. Right? How can I do this? Well, Justin Fraser is awesome. And what he does is he takes a catheter. It goes through the groin because you have, right, a huge femoral artery. He feeds it all the way up to your ischemic stroke clot. So that's usually in your MCA. And he can retrieve that. And in the process, he can grab blood that's distal to the clot, grab the clot itself, and then from the cervical artery, he can grab a peripheral blood sample. And that's all I'm saying is I want to look at those two blood samples in correlation or association with patient factors, like functional status outcomes scales that we use in the hospital, the origin of the thrombus, the time of last known normal, which is huge for stroke patients, right? When was your last known normal symptom? And then your hemorrhagic grade and mortality. So this is a diagram that I made, and again, it just shows you where my samples are coming from. So the distal artery, right, and if you think about it, that blood is just static. It's sitting there, right? It's just because there's no perfusion to that area of the artery because the thrombus is blocking it. And then the proximal sample, again, is from the cervical artery, which still has a little bit of perfusion. And so the bottom diagram shows that, you know, how he does this. And so he takes that catheter, and he can go through the clot, grab that distal sample, and grab the clot on the way out, and then grab the cervical artery blood. Specific aim number four that I have that I'm looking at is I want to look at those three biosamples, right? But I want to look at gene expression. So what genes are being expressed at the time or at the onset of ischemic stroke? And I want to associate those, again, with patient factors. So far, this is hot off the presses. We have 35 participants. And their age is roughly, and again, this is together with males and females. So their age is about 66 years old. Again, we're at a level one trauma hospital. And so I'll say a lot of our females are like 45 years old. It's insane to me that women that young are having strokes. And the majority of our patients are female, again, Caucasian because of our location. You can see that there are a lot of people, again, in Kentucky, right? But we also get participants and patients from Cincinnati, right, Ohio. We get them from Tennessee. We get them from West Virginia. And so, and again, there are a lot of rural areas. And so it's overweight and obesity is in our population. And then a lot of people have comorbidities, right? And for stroke, it's hypertension. It's a previous stroke. It's COPD. They have increase in their lipids. AFib is a huge one, diabetes. And then smoking is about half and half. They either haven't smoked or they previously or currently smoke. What's great is, and this is what we want to see, right? And so, again, this is preliminary, but it's great that we're seeing that their NIH stroke scale that we take on admission is, I'll say, worse than their discharge score. So on admission, it's either you're having a moderate to severe stroke. And then on discharge, you're really having a minor stroke, which is what you want to see. The Tiki score just tells you how much perfusion is actually in that vessel. And so you want to at least be a 2B to 3. You want full perfusion back to that part of the brain. And that's what we see because Dr. Frazier is fantastic at what he does. Last known normal to thrombectomy time, it takes about 222 minutes for this to happen, which is pretty good. It's a little under 4 hours. And then we have our infarct and edema values. And again, I don't have enough participants to be doing associations or regressions right now, so I can't tell you what's correlated to what. But hopefully 20 or more so participants, I can start figuring that out. So I just did a quick T-test, right, a paired sample T-test. And again, this is males and females together, and this is, you know, you guys can kind of relate to this, hopefully, because you are studying some of this now in class. But pH, there isn't any difference between that distal and that proximal sample, which to me is interesting because I would have thought, and I've had discussions with Robin about this, like I would have thought it would have been decreased in the distal sample. The PO2 and O2 is decreased in that distal sample, and that makes sense. There's no perfusion. I'll say that most of our patients, when this goes on, they're on the ventilator. That's why that number, the PO2, is 200, right? That's 200% oxygen. That's because events giving you that much. Their base deficits increased in the distal. Bicarb is decreased. And then you have your sodium is increased. And then potassium and calcium are also decreased. And we're still trying to figure out, right, like what's going on and why these values are what we're seeing. In the literature, I do know that, and again, a lot of people haven't researched this. This is the first time somebody's actually looked at acid bases in the brain at the time of stroke. So this is really exciting for us. But the literature says that in ischemic stroke patients, venous samples, like peripheral samples, within 24 hours of admission, if you have an increase in your calcium, then you have better functional outcomes. So maybe that's going to give us some guidance. Again, that would be if our peripheral samples are increased. And so far, they're within normal limits. So because, you know, calcium goes to 5.4, and that number is 4.3. So we just have to see what we have in our particular patient population. Oh, yes. So get ready. This is really, really, really exciting news. So gene expression. Nobody has looked at gene expression in the brain at the time of stroke. And so I analyzed two participants, and the way I'm doing this is for the peripheral sample, I'm using that as a control, and to the distal sample. And so what you're going to see next is what is being expressed. And usually people get kind of excited, right, if you have like a one-fold, two-fold increase in any gene, right, during an injury or a disease. But what we are seeing is at least 16 genes, 50-fold, at the time of stroke, which is nuts. And I just analyzed this over the weekend, so I don't know really the ins and outs, but most of these have been seen and have been investigated in MS and also in Alzheimer's. Nobody's looked at this or has had this in stroke yet. So again, we're still kind of looking into this as to what it all really means. But this is kind of interesting for us to make a story out of it, and then hopefully with more participants. Yeah?
How do you detect what genes are expressed, like, in that?
Great question. So I take that blood, like those blood samples, and then in lab I run an 84 gene PCR plate, basically, and I just see what's being expressed in those 84 genes. And then I use the peripheral blood as a control. So yeah, there's a lot of lab work that I'm not showing you that I have to do to get these values. So this is my committee. Again, Justin Frazier is the neurosurgeon. I have a basic scientist that I'm in lab with, who's Penny Packer over in the other corner. And then the bottom is my nursing committee. So we have Terry Lenny, Susan Frazier, and then Robin's girlfriend, I'm just kidding, is Kristen Ashford. And they are great help, especially the top two have been fantastic mentors. I've kind of had to go outside of nursing to get this project moving, and I've had to overcome a lot of challenges, right? Because the top two guys kind of treat you like a med student, they treat you like a resident, and the bottom people are kind of in the nursing world, and so I have to kind of keep at it. But it's good. It's paying off. And so my next steps is that, again, my IRB was approved. I don't know if you guys have had human subjects training, but you have to get a lot to get a study approved in humans. And so that was approved about a year ago, and so in that time we have 35 participants, which is great. Collecting and analyzing all the data that we're getting. I've already submitted a paper. It was actually accepted yesterday. And so, thank you. That was the first one with the young male rats. And so now I'm crunching a lot of stats for that aged males and females paper. And I have about a year left. And then I'll go on to a postdoc. And then hopefully be faculty. So, anyway, that's my presentation. So if you guys have any questions, and then if you want to contact me about nursing or how to get involved in the hospital, please let me know. I love to help out and network people when I can. So, and I also made that graphic. So when you're having a stroke, just let me know.
So the two Frasers aren't related, right?
No, the two Frasers are not related.
So we have other questions? It's good. So, but the point is that you can do a lot of research.
Yeah. We are. The thing about that is that funding, right? We're getting a lot of critiques of, like, why aren't you doing RNA-seq? Why aren't you doing this, right? And it's funding. And it's, like, the only thing that we can do right now are, like, QIAGEN kits, basically, and QIAGEN plates. And then we apply for grants, and then they come back and say, well, why can't you do this? And it's like, well, we need the grant money first to do that, but they kind of want you to do everything up front. So we're trying to think of different funding sources to do that. But, right. We have, and yeah, we're putting in another grant right now. But yeah, that's a good question. And it's frustrating. It's really, really frustrating because people get super excited and then they don't fund you. And what do? Right? You just have to keep trying. I'll say grad school, nursing school, med school is perseverance. It all is, right? You don't have to be the smartest person in the room. You just have to keep at it. Keep at it. And bother people like Robin to help you get to that next step. Yeah?
So when they take out plot, the mechanical one, I heard it was like the micro umbrella. Is that what that is?
It's a micro catheter.
I mean, like, that's how they describe it. Like, how it opens up.
Yeah. And so, like, he, like, releases the sheath, as they call it, and then it goes throughout the, like, fatty, gross clot, and then he can pull it out. And then he can go back in, and there's a little suction device on it, too, and he can suction it out. Yep.
Scar, like the scar that heart general has?
You know, I don't know about that, and I don't know if anybody's looking into that. One thing that we're being critiqued on in grants is that are you pulling out some of those endothelial cells from the artery, right? And you would think so. So we're going to try to address that also. Yeah.
So the genes that you're looking at that are amplified, are you noticing that they're in the same kind of chromosomal region? So I know you said you have a lot of analysis at this point.
You know, I don't know if they're in the same region or not. I know that when I throw them into Google, because again, this is only a couple days old, they come up together. You know, but the issue with the brain, so some of these I know are being expressed. Let's say like you have a injury to your liver, right? Some of those are going to be expressed, and what's great about your liver is that it can expand. So when these, you know, the immune factors come in, it can expand because your body has that area. If you have that expansion in your brain, you're going to have edema, and we always say, right, in the hospital, cerebral edema equals death. And so you don't want that. But I know, right, the brain is trying to repair itself. So, but yeah, I need to look into it a little bit more. But it's just crazy that it's that much, you know? It's being expressed that much. But, next year when I give this talk again, then I'll have more information on it.
There you go.
Yeah.
It's kind of quick, but just thinking about all the genes that were. So you took that measurement in the moment that, like, right after the stroke, or
yes,
during the stroke itself?
So after the stroke itself, right? The clot was already there.
Okay. So do you think that those genes are being expressed, like, in the moment, maybe causing the stroke, or do you think, like, a rise in gene expression could be signaling that a stroke is coming? And do you think that that happens over time before the stroke occurs, or do you think, I don't know how all the...
I think the, maybe Robin will have better insights because he's super smart, but I think because the stroke happened, then you're going to have like a time series of gene expression of certain genes. So that's part of my analysis, which I didn't really get into, but I want to see... based on different times, because, you know, the last known normal time to thrombectomy completion is the time itself. So if I could break that into categories, like three categories, and then I can look at gene expression of, like, low, medium, high, will I see what comes out in, like, the low points of time versus, like, 12 hours later, or, two hours versus 12 hours? Are different genes being expressed?
But you wouldn't think before the stroke happens that you would have...
I think you definitely have things, right? Because the comorbidities themselves are going to be, genes are going to be expressed. Inflammation's going to be, you know, high. Yeah. I mean, you stub your toe and you just have inflammation anyway. So, and again, these patients are super sick to begin with. Does that answer?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, Robin.
That was very good. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Let's pass over right now.
So, also, if you're interested in research, you know, in the nursing program, this is what you can do. Some people don't have that idea about what PhD students do in nursing, but you're right in the clinics, you're working with samples, you're actually working, and you're not in massive debt either, right?
Yeah, you can do that.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Your file's already out.
Can I just...
No, that's mine. That's my thing. You have it.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So I'm going to continue on with class stuff. Alrighty. So where we are, we left off with your wonderful GI stuff. And hopefully, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Bye everyone. Come catch me.
Great. So hopefully that you've looked over the PowerPoints or heard the echo from Thursday last week, and we finished up the renal, and then we got on to GI. And so we're going to wrap up GI real quick.
Where is ACE Mini?
Pardon?
Where is ACE Mini?
The angio...
Yeah. The converting enzyme.
Oh. Where is it made? Anybody?
Lungs.
Lungs?
Made in the lungs.
Yes.
Which? The kidneys, and then it's released by the
kidneys. Well, it's in the blood.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because this is released, and the blood's going through the whole body, right? And so, yeah, it's in the blood.
It's kind of directed towards the kidneys.
But it's in the blood. Once it's in the blood, then it, you know,
it's where it needs to
be. Yeah, like renin, right?
I don't know if anybody else has problems. I've heard the GI stuff. I couldn't get the PowerPoint or the podcast or whatever.
I just downloaded them right now. Yeah.
I turned on 3 computers.
Okay, so somebody, she said she had a problem downloading the GI stuff, but I just downloaded it this morning right here on this computer, because this computer didn't have the updated version. Unless it was like some glitch in the system, like the web wasn't working or the server. Give it a try again, see what happens. Okay, so we've got to kind of hurry, and I'm going to try to wrap this up. Hopefully we can finish everything today. And what happens next week at 8 o'clock on Tuesday? We have a wonderful final exam, right? And it's going to start at 8, so bring your coffee, get hyped up, and get going. And we'll address more review questions on Thursday, so definitely read through everything for Thursday.
2 hours.
You got 2 hours, but you won't take that much time. Because why? These are going to be multiple choice questions primarily, because I get to turn that around quickly to grade, right? And it's hard to grade open response questions in such a short time. And so you're going to have more than 150 points, right? So it kind of gives you that boost. Some of those questions, I know that you're all interested in it, are actually, I even took some from the 152 kind of idea to kind of help you out and boost that grade up. And so I expect a high average on this final, but I know that it's, you know, finals week is hard. Some of the questions I thought, oh my gosh, they're going to get like 50% if they didn't even read anything. It's so easy. Oh, and there's some true and false, too.
Do you know if our final GCCR will be graded before the final?
Yeah, the GCCR is supposed to be finished up this week, actually, by Friday. I don't even think there is a short answer. I haven't really finished it. Yeah, and then maybe we'll put a bonus question on related to some content that we just heard, maybe.
Okay.
Who knows? Okay. Well, it's 150 points, so about 75 questions, right? But some might have a little, you know, maybe there's 4 points to a question if you had to do something, right? Yeah. Okay. I have to still kind of tweak it. Okay? Is that what we're doing with the final? Now, if we're wrapping up this, so hopefully you go through the GI system. There's so much, you know, you can have a whole course on the gastrointestinal system, right? You could have a course just covering this, like every subject that we've gone through. But there's some really neat aspects that you should generally get down. And we've kind of gone through this on the echo already in the podcast. You know, you start with digestion where?
In the mouth.
And you have enzymes that are released in the salivary gland, amylase. And then it goes into the stomach, right? Low pH. Do you have absorption much in the stomach? Absorption of nutrients into the body? Why not? Just a big picture. Why not?
It's part too acidic.
It's too acidic. What would that be a problem? It's breaking down proteins. It's breaking them apart. It's breaking down those big proteins into smaller.
It can't, like, pass the membrane because it would
show the parts. Exactly. That acidic environment, if it was to reach the endothelial cells in your stomach, right, what would it do? It's going to tear them up, right? So you're not absorbing things. But that's a misconception. A lot of times people have is that you're not absorbing the nutrients in the stomach. It's too acidic. So what happens if you take away that mucus layer? Which cells make the mucus in the stomach?
Goblet
cells, exactly. But what happens if you're eating something or drinking something, primarily alcohol, that could act in hard alcohol that could destroy that mucus layer? Now, what have you exposed those endothelial cells to? Acid and strong acid. So then you get an ulcer, right? And then you get an ulcer, that's not good, right? Because then it's going to start chewing through the stomach, and then you have a bleeding ulcer, and not only that, you might get stuff into your bloodstream, right? And that's not good either. So this is what happens, and people wonder, why am I having such stomach pains? I've just had a, you know, shot of whiskey again. I'll take away the pain another shot, and boy, it just makes it much worse. So there's lots of times that people have actually can get even septicemia from this chronic alcoholism because of chronic ulcers. So it's really quite interesting to think about. When you're partying, you know, after finals, think about that kind of moderation. All right. And then you think about acid reflux, right? People might have acid reflux, eat spicy food, it irritates you. And so you keep regurgitating up into what? Your esophagus, right?
Is there a problem with that? Why is that such a big problem?
Doesn't that acid eventually make the cells like cause dysplasia and then the esophageal cells turn into stomach cells?
Yeah, this really irritates the esophagus, right? And especially right out of the stomach. So you feel like heartburn. It's not really heartburn. It's acid reflux and gastric. But also, you can actually increase your chance of getting cancer in your esophagus. Because of the continual irritation. So things like this are really important to understand about the GI system. You can go through and memorize which enzymes where. I don't want you to do that. I want you to just get to some of the big picture points, too. Bulimic, yeah, that keep vomiting, problems like that too. It's just not good to get that. But when you think about it, and probably everybody's had an MS attack, right, where you vomit, isn't that something bizarre that all of a sudden you get a lot of saliva that just goes into your mouth, and you know, whoa, I better go find the, the royal pot or something, right? And then you realize what's going to happen. But how does that, that reflex, how does that work so fast to get the saliva, and so much saliva that can come out to try to protect your mouth? And all that's working together, those reflexes. People actually study the neural reflex of emesis, of vomiting, to try to understand that circuit. So it's kind of interesting. And some people have dysfunction in that circuit, and they kind of keep getting saliva in their mouth, and it's not part of the normal circuit. So this is really kind of interesting to think of outside the box a little bit. Also, what's really interesting, which we don't cover in here, is the blood supply throughout here. It's really quite phenomenal. The food that comes into the duodenum right here from the stomach, actually that can pick up, those cells can detect the food that comes into the first part of the small intestine and actually detect it if it's kind of fatty food or not. Wow, isn't that weird? And then these cells can release hormones into the bloodstream, and the bloodstream after the duodenum then goes on over to the gallbladder and the pancreas. Is that not weird? So the blood is monitoring the duodenum, can release hormones like CCK, cholecystokinin, right, or secretin, and that hormone then goes over, and what does CCK do? CCK can cause gallbladder contraction and the pancreas to release their contents. And if they release their contents, what does the gallbladder do? Bile, right? Bile goes into the intestine. And what's the main function of bile that we kind of think of? It's a waste product, get rid of waste, right? And to emulsify those lipids, right? And so now, that fatty diet, you get an increase in, bile that's released. So then you can emulsify them and absorb them or get them out of the body. So it's really quite neat. And not only that, those hormones that are released from the duodenum, they can go over and work on the stomach as well. And the stomach actually has a blood supply that comes around the stomach from here and releases hormones like gastrin. And then that blood supply goes to the rest of the stomach. And what does gastrin do?
Increase
HCl. From what type of cells?
Parietal
cells. And so you see how that's really so neat that blood supply comes, detects, and then goes to the next target before the hormones get diluted out. It's pretty cool. Where else do you remember that happening? Kind of that we covered about with the blood supply being the next target tissue, carrying a high concentration of a hormone before it gets diluted. Review. Come on. You know it. From where to where? Hypothalamus releasing hormones, anterior pituitary. You see, you get the same idea. It's really cool when you start to put all the anatomy together.
What happens if you don't have a gallbladder? You have removed, so what happens then?
Yeah, so the idea is, you hear a lot of people that with a gallbladder ectomy, or they've taken out the gallbladder, gallstones, sometimes take that out. So what generally happens? You don't eat fatty foods, right? Because you're going to have some problems with eating fatty foods. That fat's going to go inside there, it's going to cause you some problems. You can't digest it well, and it causes diarrhea. You get a poop that won't be normal, right? And it can't break down, the bacteria can't break it down well as either. Nowadays, actually, and you think about, you had your gallbladder out, can you still get gallstones?
Yes.
Nowadays, the gastroenterologist, or you go to an ER, and they have pain, real bad pain in there. Oh, is it appendicitis, or is it a gallbladder? And they'll do a scan, they'll find out you have a gallbladder, or maybe it's pancreatitis or something, but you'll find out that's a gallstones. And you wonder, wow, but I had my gallbladder out. They don't even care anymore if you had your gallbladder out, because you can still get gallstones in that bile duct that happens. And that can be really severe, because what's going to happen? That backs up into the liver. Then what happens in the liver? That's draining out of the blood, and now you have some of these enzymes or bile that builds up in your blood, and then you can actually have some real bad consequences from that building up in the blood. Because what would the bile do in your blood? Start to break down lipids, which is red blood cells and everything else. And you can have an increase in septicemia problems too, because of the backup and bacterial problems. Anybody else? Okay, so that's cool. So to kind of make you think about the GI system, it's really cool. There's a lot of interesting aspects to it, but we don't have time to go through it. I'm not going to test you on the different anatomy parts of the small intestine. You can always look that stuff up. All right, but the idea, some of these big ideas, what's the pancreas release? What's the gallbladder release? What's going on here? And you don't have to memorize these different enzymes. Old tests had this. We spent a lot more time on GI sometimes in the past, but the general idea is what's going on here, right? Start to break down some stuff in the mouth. Digestion, mechanical, enzymatic. Then in the stomach, you have pepsin is the main enzyme to break it down, and the HCl breaks down more molecules. And then when you get in the small intestine, this is where all those enzymes come out of the pancreas, dump into the small intestine, and really start chewing up proteins, right? And this is why pancreatitis is so severe, right? If you have an inflamed pancreas, what can happen? It swells up. All those enzymes do what? They get into your bloodstream. So what happens when they get in the bloodstream, all those enzymes? What are they going to do? Chew up everything in your blood, right? And this is why you can have, die quickly with pancreatitis, for one thing, too. So Kentucky ranks like number one in the country. I think we're right with West Virginia with pancreatic cancer. Usually it's very severe. Once they diagnose it, a lot of times it's like 3 months, 6 months to live, and that's it. So not very good. All right, so on the enzymes, I don't want you to memorize all these different enzymes. I just want you to get the idea that where the general ones are taking place. But you do have enzymes from the pancreas and in the small intestine, and that they work to break down molecules like glycogen down to glucose, right? You got to break these things down to simple molecule structures, amino acids, like glycogen to glucose or starch to glucose, so you can absorb it, right, across the small intestine. On the hormones, we covered some of these in the endocrine chapter, but a few of these you should really pay some attention to. Gastrin, we've talked about. Gastrin comes from the stomach, right? And it can come from the small intestine as well. Works on the stomach to basically cause acid secretion, right? So that's really important. And then CCK and secretin are two other hormones that you really should pay attention to if you're taking standardized exams as well. But for here, too, the CCK is really quite neat because it works on two structures, the gallbladder and the pancreas, and it basically can monitor that high-fat diet that you might have after eating a Wendy's hamburger, and then it's going to work on getting that bile released, but also pancreatic enzymes, right? So CCK, take home here, is gallbladder and pancreas, right? Monitors in the small intestine the fat that develops there from the digestion. Secretin is quite neat, too, but it works primarily on the pancreas, and it can also monitor what kind of food is coming into the duodenum, the first part of the small intestine. All right, so secretin for the pancreas, CCK for pancreas and gallbladder. There's some aspects in the literature, if you take some other courses or hormone course, endocrine course, that actually gastrin and CCK are not just additive in their effects, they're synergistic. So when they're actually released together, they have more than an additive effect on the pancreas. They can actually cause more release than just one added to the other hormone. So it's kind of an interesting aspect to have these two together. So don't worry about these other hormones for our purpose. They're just there, but get you kind of an idea what's happening. Of course, everything that comes across the lumen in the GI tract needs to get transported one way or another. It's just not, going across the cells or between cells. So the take-home here is that you have pumps again, right? We've talked about these kind of pumps. A lot driven by sodium-potassium ATPase, right? Setting up a gradient so it can transport across. What's kind of neat here, too, is the lumen, you have a lot of bacteria, right, in your GI tract, right? And that bacteria is very important. What's that bacteria do when it breaks down the food? It produces a gas, CO2, right? It doesn't all come out as my kids would say, gas bombs, right? Flatulence, you know, farts, whatever you want to call it, right? But a lot of that gas, you can produce in one day, you probably, on average, produce about 10 liters of CO2 in your GI tract. Wow, 10 liters. It doesn't, that's a lot of gas bombs, if you will, right? But it doesn't come out that way. What happens to that CO2? It goes into, because it goes right through the biofilm membranes, right? And inside those cells, you have carbonic anhydrase. And then it can go right into the bloodstream and you can transport it as bicarb. Then where does it go? The lungs. And then convert it right back to CO2 and you blow it out, right? So you get that idea. It's pretty neat. The bacteria developing its CO2 from digestion in your GI tract and you're blowing out the CO2 product, but it's been transported by bicarb to get to your lungs. I think that's really quite cool. So that's pretty neat to think about. So we do want to remember these different cell types and what they do. The chief cell, remember that little, anybody listen to the podcast, how to remember what the chief cell does? Yeah, very good. And so how does pepsinogen break down to pepsin? By what?
The acid in the stomach.
The acid in the stomach, the HCl in the stomach. So that's really neat. And you think about the chief and the tribe having a Pepsi, okay? That's the way to remember this. All right? Parietal cells, two things that they release, HCl, acid, and intrinsic factor. All right? And then the goblet cells, which are not shown here, goblet cells release the mucus, right, to help protect that stomach lining. Now, you can have actually disease. We can go through it. Well, let's just go through this first, and I'll talk back about that intrinsic factor. So this is the idea of how these hormones work. Just a real note again, CCK on pancreas and gallbladder, secretin pretty much on the pancreas, all right, and gastrin. This figure has confused people over the years, figures like this, because people think when they're writing an open response question, the hormone is released into the stomach contents, then goes on over to the cells, right? That's not happening, right? The hormone is released into the blood supply goes to that part of the tissue and then causes these responses. So what happens to the enzymes that are made, like in the amylase or pepsin that's made in the stomach and released? What happens to those, you know, when they enter into the small intestine? Just to kind of get you thinking about it. They're broken down, right? They're just proteins. They're broken down to amino acids, and they're taken back in the body. So it's a pretty neat, efficient system, actually. All right. So when we talk about GI, too, we have to think about some of the classic experiments, like with Pavlov. And there's a really good research lab here in the animal sciences where they actually have the cows on their research farm with the hole that's in the cow's side, and they can actually put food into different parts of the cow's stomach and take it out and see how digestive processes occur with different foods and that they want to look at. You know, it's important for the food supply. That is a call that reminds me that we're going to have an exam soon. Okay, a quiz. And then, but Pavlov's experiments. Anybody remember Pavlov's experiments from psychology? What is it, generally? The bell, they ring the bell, they feed the dog, right? They ring the bell, they feed the dog, and then they can just ring the bell, and what's the dog doing?
Salivating.
So what kind of reflex do you call that? Classical conditioned reflex. Conditioned reflex. It's kind of like getting used to coming to class for a quiz. You've got you all conditioned, right? Sort of that. So a conditioned reflex. All right, so we know that. So the idea is these transport mechanisms, as we've talked about, you know, transport, glucose, fructose, you have different transporters, and these transporters are really important because you can have defects in these. You can have genetic defects in these transporters, and that's really an issue. Chylomicrons, like we talked about, bile salts breaking down the fats, they're actually absorbed across those microvilli, which increases that surface area. I mean, this was a Nobel Prize winning stuff, right? The guys, for a long time, didn't understand how you broke down fat. The guys at Southwestern in Dallas figured this out, and they actually got a Nobel Prize for it. Bernstein and I forgot the other guy's name. Southwestern Dallas is a phenomenal med school. They had five Nobel laureates on their faculty. Five Nobel laureates on their faculty, Southwestern in Dallas. Really quite an amazing place. The only med school that has that many Nobel laureates. But to understand this whole process was really quite neat with the bile salts breaking them down and then going into this lateral, like your lymphatic system, to carry away these chylomicrons that are basically fat globules. So water and reuptake real fast to kind of get through there. You know, you make a lot of saliva, can go into the stomach, you get a lot of secretions from the pancreas, liver, bile, that all enters in the small intestine. Most of your reabsorption of amino acids and water occurs in your small intestine, all right? But your large intestine can kind of be that final tweak. It can actually help pull more water out of, or actually get rid of, or let it just, you know, go out through poop. So this is kind of your final tweaking of the water balance. But you can think of 10 liters in, 10 liters out, right? You know, reabsorb basically through the whole process. So it's really quite neat to think about all these different processes. Vitamins. Let's just cover a little bit about vitamins. Really important, too. What are vitamins? Why do we talk about vitamins? They're essential vitamins, the ones that we can't create. We need those. And you don't have to memorize all the different vitamins, but you should know that there are water-soluble vitamins, like these WS means water-soluble, and there are fat-soluble vitamins. And those are sometimes standardized exam kind of questions, A, D, E, and K. Why is there such an important understanding of what these vitamins do? Some of those are needed for blood clotting, right, like vitamin K. If you have a deficiency in vitamin K, you can't blood clot well. B12 is very important for making red blood cells. So if you don't have B12, for example, you might end up with pernicious anemia, and then you don't make RBCs. So that's a real big problem, right? And how do you get vitamin B12 across the GI tract? Anybody study that before in some class or something? You need intrinsic factor to get that across. So where does intrinsic factor come from? Parietal cells. But what if your parietal cells aren't working right and don't make intrinsic factor? You then become anemic. Your RBCs go down because your parietal cells weren't working. Is that not weird? That is weird, right? So actually, this is somewhat of an autoimmune disease, like that NMDA disease that we were just talking about with Sarah. Is that people have an autoimmune disease that attacks their parietal cells, so they don't make intrinsic factors, so then they become anemic because they can't make red blood cells. So how do they correct it? Well, you can give them intrinsic factor, and that can help it. But then when you find out these things, sometimes the problem of your anemia isn't due to the intrinsic factor. It's because you're not getting B12, right? So maybe you're not getting B12 in your diet. So they can test this out and find out if it's a dietary problem or you're not making intrinsic factor. You might hear of people getting B12 injections into their muscles, for example, to help with these problems. So it's really quite cool. The other part about vitamins, lipid-soluble, water-soluble, is that the problem is if you take too many of these vitamins that are fat-soluble, they go into the fat. It takes a long time for them to get out versus a water-soluble vitamin. So then you can get toxic effects from too much vitamins, right? So that's a problem too. All right. So that's the GI systems that we've talked about. And I got to send this to Gregory real fast. Oh, my God. He needs this email. He's taking the quiz right now, so let me fix this thing. And he's going to email it back. Okay, so that's that. And I didn't get to really talk about the last chapter yet, but we will do that real quick on Thursday.